This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Researchers have said for years that families that eat at the dinner table regularly tend to have children with better grades, lower rates of depression. The list of benefits goes on and on. A new book suggests that putting a decent meal on the table every night is not that simple. It can be a struggle even for middle-class families. For working-class and poor families, that's even a more difficult problem, and the brunt of this pressure is placed on women. The struggle of nine families in the Triangle are detailed in a book, Pressure Cooker, Why Home Cooking Won't Solve Our Problems and What We Can Do About It. Joining me now are the co-authors of the book. Sarah Bowen is a professor of sociology at North Carolina State University. Her work focuses on food systems. Hello, Sarah. Welcome back.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Jocelyn Brenton, a professor of sociology at Ithaca College. Her research is in the area of families, food, health, and inequality. Jocelyn, welcome.
Hi, Frank. Thanks for having me.
Jocelyn, let me start with you. What inspired this book?
So this research started back in 2012, and around this time we saw a lot of concerns about a rise in population weight gain and what people are eating. There's concerns about large-scale food production, unpronounceable ingredients in our food, and just generally the dangers that industrial agriculture can pose to us and our children. And one of the most popular solutions to this problem of people's diets and the food system has been for people to, women in particular, to get back into the kitchen and reconnect with food and put a really good meal on the table. So that's the message we were hearing, but we weren't really hearing a lot about the barriers that families experience. So that's what really inspired this research. We wanted to go out and talk with everyday people, mostly mothers, some grandmothers, who put a meal on the table. We tagged along with them to the grocery store as well and just observed them in their homes to try to figure out what does it take to put a meal on the table these days.
And Sarah, this research involved initially 150 families in the Triangle, right? What did you find out? What kinds of questions were you asking and what did you learn?
Yeah, so it involved 124 poor and working class families. That was the bigger study, and we ended up following those families over 5 years. And then it involved another 30 families that Jocelyn interviewed for her dissertation. She was a graduate student at NC State at that time. And so we asked them, in the beginning, we just asked them questions about food. What do you feed your kids? Do you have food rules at your house? Who makes the dinner? How do you feel about cooking? And then with the observations, we also went to grocery stores with all of the families. In the observation part, that was 12 families. We went to doctor's appointments and WIC appointments. We were in their houses as people were making dinner and eating dinner and before and after school to really get an idea of what everyday life and also food beliefs and ideas looked like.
What stands out for you in those conversations, those many, many conversations you had?
I think two things stand out. One is that across the board, food was really important to almost everyone. They had strong food memories, many of which were good, some of which were bad from childhood. It was all mothers and grandmothers of young children, and all of them felt that food and cooking was an important part of their job, and feeding kids was one of the most central things they did. But then the other thing is that across the board, almost everyone felt like, even though they were trying so hard, that they were failing to really measure up to the expectations of what these dinners should look like, what a good mom does in the kitchen. And that looked differently for different families in terms of how they felt they were not measuring up, but they almost all felt that way and blame themselves.
Yeah, well, let's pull that apart because there's a couple of things going on there. Jocelyn, I'll ask you to start. You know, one is the barriers to sort of meeting this standard and what they are, particularly for poor and working class families. And then the perception, right, this norm somehow that gets in your head that you're responsible for it. Let's start with the actual barriers and how difficult it is, both in terms of time and expense, to provide these kind of meals that seem to be making their way into the popular media.
Sure. So one of the barriers, as you know, is just money shortages. And so food's pretty expensive for the average family these days. And there were certainly a lot of people who just weren't able to afford the kinds of foods they wanted. And the expectation is that you're not just putting any meal on the table, but that ideally you're putting a very nutritious meal on the table. Maybe this meal includes organic foods that you buy locally. And of course, these kinds of foods are more expensive. Time shortages across the board for poor and working class and middle class families, they all talked about time shortages. So you have people who are working 40 plus hours outside the home. Nowadays, children are enrolled in a lot of extracurricular activities, and parents are spending their time after work shuttling their kids to and from these activities. So you have families that are really pressed for time. Even people who weren't employed full-time, if they were employed part-time, they worked shift work, and sometimes that shift work could be unpredictable. So this also made their general schedules unpredictable. So it made it difficult to come together for a family meal at the end of the day. And another significant barrier is that it is mostly women who are doing this work of feeding the family. So they're sort of carrying this work on their shoulders alone without other family members pitching in.
Yeah, and let's talk too about this norm, this sense that you're failing. I mean, even if you had the time and the money to put it on the table, it has to look a certain way and feel a certain way. And that's a kind of an image that's, I think, bound up also with perhaps a false nostalgia about the way it was, but also the way it should be. So, Sarah, maybe I'll ask you to talk more about that.
Yeah, I think on one hand, we talk about this in our book. If you look back, women, people have been telling women in particular, and it is usually directed to women, that they need to cook differently for many, many generations. And so the particular messages have changed in terms of what they're doing wrong. But the idea that women are doing something wrong, and if they would just start cooking differently, that's not new. But I think the expectations have ramped up in terms of, you know, what kind of dinners we're supposed to make. And they need to be from scratch. They need to be local if possible. They need to be diverse foods. Our kids need to have diverse palates so they can show that they, you know, they have good tastes. And as you mentioned, I think there is this false nostalgia, this idea that if we could just go back to the time of our great grandmothers, that it would be that this is what we need to do. But that's not realistic either. It's a very white ideal of a great grandmother on a farm. And I have one great grandmother that was like that. She was an immigrant from Sweden, and they moved to a farm in Illinois. And you know, she killed the chicken on Sundays for the Sunday dinner. But that ignores a lot of grandmothers. Like my other grandmother worked in a factory, and she didn't have time to cook a big dinner most nights. And there are so many of our grandmothers that look like that that's not included in these images.
My mother's joke to this day is when she sees home cooking, she won't go in because it wasn't that good around her house. Or my grandmother was not famous for her cooking. But this is that part of this, so much is bound up in the image. And in particular, the pressure, Jocelyn, for minority women and immigrant women today to live up this ideal. Talk about the way this plays out and did play out in the interviews that you did.
Sure. Yeah. So I think when people think about food and they think about expectations, we just have this universal idea of what a healthy meal looks like. And people aren't necessarily thinking about race or ethnicity or the experiences of immigrants. And this definitely came up in our interviews. For example, one of the women in the book, her name is Ray Donahue. She grew up in the South. She grew up eating Sunday dinners, and she loved these meals, and she had great memories around them. And fast forward 25 years now, she's married. She and her husband work 40 plus hours outside the home. They have one son, and they don't get together for the traditional Sunday meals anymore. And Ray's really worried that her traditions and her ways of eating as a Black mother are sort of being lost, and that she's not passing these wonderful traditions on to her son. But the thing that really worries her and that she's trying to figure out is, how do I feed my child? How do I feed my child nutritious foods, but foods that also represent our cultural traditions and ways of eating? And she wasn't really sure how to deal with that dilemma.
And Sarah, there's other problems in terms of access, too. And you talk about this in your book. You did your research in Raleigh. And here's where the idea of food deserts show up, and also the expense of some of these minimally processed foods we're talking about.
Yeah. So a lot of our interviews took place in Southeast Raleigh, and it was in a particular neighborhood where the only grocery store in the neighborhood closed right at the beginning of our study. So there was a lot of talk about how this had become a food desert. Another grocery store moved in, but that just closed a few months ago. So certainly we saw very clearly how uneven access to supermarkets was. And I think that did matter, especially for a lot of the moms in our study in Raleigh. They didn't have a car, so they would have to take the bus to the store and then maybe get a taxi to get all those groceries home. And so that definitely made it harder. But one thing that also became very clear is that in terms of the inequality of food and the things that are making it hard for people, the access to supermarkets was not nearly as important as other things, including especially food prices. And so a lot of the moms said, that they hadn't necessarily gone to that store anyway because they were definitely willing to travel for the store they perceived as cheapest. So I think spatial access to stores certainly mattered, but food prices and just not having the money to buy food was something that came up again and again and again.
Jocelyn, though, this seems like we're really sort of in the midst of a real paradox here, because on the one hand, you can see the barriers to the kind of healthy eating that would. I mean, we know some of these outcomes. We're seeing higher rates of diabetes, hypertension, all of these, and much higher percentages in the populations that we're talking about. So on the one hand, there is something going on here that has to do with food. But your point is that we shouldn't be shaming the victims, certainly. So what do we need to do about this? Because the answer can't be just eat more processed foods because it's cheaper.
Yeah, you're right. That's not the answer. And certainly individual effort on the part of families matters, and we don't want to downplay that. And in fact, the mothers we spoke with, one of the major things that we took away from the study is that people are trying very hard to figure out this food dilemma, and they're spending a lot of time and effort in their individual homes trying to make ends meet and trying to feed their families the most nutritious meals that they can. But what we argue in the book is that we do need to start looking outside the home, because at this point, individual effort isn't quite enough. And we need policies. We need to work at the community level. And there's also probably some things we can be doing at the individual level. But at the policy level, what we talk about is that we need to make food a basic human right. Food shouldn't be a commodity or a privilege for families. And what we know from the research is that when families have enough to eat, everybody's thriving. And so that's something that we want to make sure happens. And so policy changes can include expanding the amount that we spend on the food stamp program, because for many of the families in our study, food stamps is what allowed them to keep food in their cupboards. And they were using those food stamps to feed their children a relatively nutritious meal. And we also say we need to work at the community level. So how can we talk about making our lunch programs in our schools better and healthier food, and making universal school lunches so that it's available to all? So these are some of the bigger policies that we need to put in place to make sure that all families have the opportunity to eat a good meal.
Some of those policies bear directly on food, as you say, food lunch programs, food stamps, our EBT program. But also some of the other policies that bear directly on the family budget, expanding Medicaid, for instance. Any state that would refuse to do that is telling poor families, you're going to have to make hard decisions about what you eat, and we may force you into this less expensive and less healthy food system because we're not supporting your medical needs, right?
That's exactly right. So there are food policies, as you know, but there are actually bigger policies we need to see put in place to help families be healthy in general. So we do need universal health care. We do need paid maternity leave and paternity leave. We need just general family leave policies, and we need paid sick leave. And these are some of the things that would really help families in general care for their children and make sure that children are healthy. So food matters, but food's part of this bigger web of things that need to happen for families to be doing well.
And Sarah, you've said that there are other policies as well. If we think that food is a problem and we think nutrition is a problem, rather than blame each family, we can take responsibility for outlawing some of, or at least restricting some of the kinds of marketing and sales that are actually contributing to this.
Right. So in addition to needing to support families, one of the challenges that all of these mothers faced is that they were trying through their own decisions to solve these problems that are definitely problems in the food system, like their fears about food safety or the ingredients in their food. And so instead of expecting moms to figure this out through their decisions at the grocery store, which of these foods is safe, we need to strengthen the regulations so that it's safe for everyone. Another example is with food marketing. So we allow junk food to be marketed to kids, and then we throw up our hands when kids, you know, want to eat a lot of chips. But a lot of countries, Sweden, but also Chile, just passed laws. They don't allow junk food companies to market to kids. And so we need to think about, you know, what do we need to do at the national level and the community level instead of just expecting moms to figure it out.
And I guess, Jocelyn, too, if we take a look at some of our policies, so many hidden subsidies that make our food, especially the industrial produced food that is less healthy for our children, cheaper or seem cheaper. Transportation subsidies, highway subsidies, rail subsidies that allow us to send our pigs from North Carolina to get fattened up in Iowa and then sent back to one of a very few processors who then set the price for the food. I mean, all these things are unseen. What I just said in that one sentence was a lot to absorb because most people have not heard it before. And yet it's the truth of your food system, and it happens every single day. And these are, Jocelyn, I suppose, some of the unseen subsidies that also, you know, make it more difficult for the women, mostly women that you talk to make the choices that they'd like to make.
Yeah, they do make it difficult. And one of the things that really struck me in interviewing middle-class mothers is that, generally speaking, they're really aware, in fact, hyper-aware of what's going wrong with the food system. These are mothers that tend to have a higher level of education. Some of them work in the health field themselves, and they're terrified about what's in the food system and what they could inadvertently be feeding their children that could make them sick. So you have these mothers that are working full time outside the home. They're on their free time. They're on the internet. They're looking up healthy recipes. And they're also looking at articles that are saying, hey, watch out for this and that that's in our food, the latest scare. And this is really making them feel concerned. And they don't feel confident that the government or is helping to make the food system any safer. So they're feeling all of this burden and weight on their shoulders. And this feels like a really big responsibility. And in fact, there are some real concerns with our food system. And so they're not making that up. And they really do want to find a way to protect their children. Unfortunately, protecting your children involves spending a lot of money on expensive foods, shopping around at multiple grocery stores to get the best deals on organic. And so this takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of resources.
And a lot of time to organize as well, Sarah. I mean, as Jocelyn and you have both pointed out, these homemakers are very, very much aware and working very, very hard to do the best they can for their families. Not only is it difficult to find the food and pay for the food, but you also don't have the time to organize. If it's a systems problem, that means, you know, sort of getting a political solution and organizing. And who has time to do that if you're working two jobs and 60 hours a week?
Yeah, and I think we also just have a cultural a belief that we tend to fall back on in the United States that we saw that people blame themselves. Like, again and again, moms in lots of different contexts, if they felt like they weren't quite feeding their kids the way they wanted to, they blame themselves and they talk about, like, well, if only I would start chopping vegetables on the weekends, or if I started meal planning, or I started doing this, then I could get it right. And a lot of them, you know, they turned back into what I could be doing better instead of thinking, like, this system is failing me and lots of people.
Sarah Bowen is a professor of sociology at North Carolina State University. Jocelyn Brenton is a professor of sociology at Ithaca College. And their book is called Pressure Cooker, Why Home Cooking Won't Solve Our Problems and What We Can Do About It. And we've got links to their book at our website, stateofthings.org. Sarah, Jocelyn, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Just ahead, we're going to talk about a project that combines art and science in the exploration of the Neuse River. Stay with us on The State of Things.